Welcome, welcome, my friends, to the Beggars and Brawlers podcast. This is episode 73, recorded Friday, the 8th of December, 2023. As our book is live, we have one last preview of it, Queen of Blood and Blasphemy, plus some talk afterwards about making good on promises I wrote 6 years ago. So just a quick note before we start, this is chapter 5, our last preview chapter of the audiobook for Queen of Blood and Blasphemy, Hyde Color Chronicles book 4, final book, and it is spoilerific. So if you haven't read the other books and haven't listened to these chapters, you probably don't want to listen to this one. But I'm assuming that's not you, so here it is.
Surprise tightens in my gut, excitement quickly following. We got to him. Even if everything goes wrong here, Begdil will have a chance at his life. My hands grip the bedframe. I wish I was the one standing there. It is high time we talked, Begdil says, voice the even keel of a monk in his concentration, as one temple. I am not the one who split us, Nurimace answers in the same tone, plus a touch of condescension. That is a matter of opinion, Begdil answers, and I break into a smile. Not only because it's what I would say, well, maybe a little more polite than I would have done it, but because it's a senior monk saying it, the head of an entire temple on my side, when all my memories are of entire temples set against me. Your reactions at the wedding, Begdil goes on, indicated you saw the veracity of Alethea's insights. I could kiss the man. Surprise registers in the bond with Anon, and some distracted part of me notes that I really need to learn how to control my thoughts. The rest of me focuses on the conversation happening here, on the sight of my enemy just a few feet from where Anon stands, cheekbones stark as ever. Nurimace purses his lips as if considering. Indeed, I did, and she was right. I did all those things, as Chosen have ever done, for the good of the temple, for the good of the faith. I would expect you to understand that by now. Allying us with the witches, our sworn enemies? The word witches makes me cringe, but I was right to send Begdil. I still don't think this conversation has much chance of changing things, other than learning if Nurimace has the monocle. But Begdil is just the right blend of traditional views and the changes the temple needs to make. I did not ally, I subjugated, as we have ever sought. Begdil just gazes a moment, gathering his thoughts. I am sure you remember a time when it was different, when we were yet novices, and the split between us did not seem more than that which has ever split men and women. A difference, and yet an attraction. Is that not split enough, Brother Begdil? I do not hear word of your little sect allying with the witches who left. Begdil hesitates again, choosing his words, I'm guessing. He knows he can't be as direct as usual here if he wants to accomplish anything. I have come to believe, he says at last, that it would be in the best interest of the temple, of the faith, if we were to look more to our commonalities than our differences. Nurimace folds his hands and takes a few slow steps on the gravel. You are lucky, brother. Duty never called you to marry as it has me. One of the drawbacks of the theocratic path. So let me tell you something your insights may not give you access to. The sort of thing you can only learn from experience. There is no commonality between man and woman stronger than our differences. Only a power struggle, disguised and tangled by desire in many cases, until the struggle simplifies to you against her, and then it will be war as open as the one we wage against the Therakins. Marriages are ever thus. Sturgjon appeared happily married until the plague took Iwanala. And perhaps that is why we are here, Nurimace says, spinning in place with that surprising grace, and walking in the other direction. Sturgjon's weaknesses. I intend to take a firmer hand. But you did not come here to debate love. He steps into the water, and I suck in a breath. Here it is. The sharing of waters, when two monks talk with blinds dropped, connected by water, ostensibly holding no secrets from each other. There is, of course, always the technique of just not thinking about anything you don't want the other person to see, but it's much less reliable than a blind to block out all intrusion. Still, Begdil assured me he could do it, and for all the man's relative unpleasantness and outdated views, I don't doubt his ability as a seer. That doesn't mean I don't hold my breath when his feet touch water. Don't expect every second to see Nerimace's eyes widen and for him to snap orders for a contingent of overseers to come capture me. That is the worst we risk, I think. Nerimace undoubtedly knows almost everything else we do. But it seemed worth it to try to draw information out of him, temple head to temple head. Nerimace's face doesn't change as they connect through the waters, so Begdil must be keeping his thoughts in check. I came to talk of the floods, he says, following the script we discussed. I am sure your new immersions have been the same as ours. We need a plan, brother. The threat is bigger than our differences. The Chosen's face stays blank. And what is your plan? To come begging to me? Or will you tell me, as head of whatever you're calling yourselves, that faith alone will be enough? That I only need repent, and we'll all be saved? What else could there be? Begdil asks, and I wince. He's the right monk for this talk, but that doesn't mean he has the subtlety of someone like Estrija or even Anon. He's trying to lead Nerimace to the monocle, to whether they have it yet, but his question feels a little too obvious. Nerimace doesn't bite. A firm hand. That is what instills faith and keeps it through hard times. I think you'll find I run a much tighter ship than did my predecessor. Begdil's face stays smooth. Sturgeon did not have monks disappearing in his own city. I start. I haven't heard anything about monks disappearing, but then, if they are, the temple would likely be trying to keep it quiet. I am not disappearing them, if that's what you're implying, Marime scowls. If anything, that's the witches reacting to how I've shifted the tides. We have seen something else, Begdil says, returning to the script. In our latest immersions. A tool. Something sent by UJ. The details are never clear. But I thought if we could reference our immersions with yours, we might gain some direction. This is a better dig for information, but the tension in my belly still says Nerimace knows everything and is just playing with us. By that, the lean man says, I infer you do not yet have one? Begdil shifts his stance. I do not even properly know what it is, brother. Ah, a lie. You're first, I think. Admirable for one more given to a seer's insights than the theocrat's poetry. Still, I think I see the truth behind it. You don't yet have a monocle, which is why you've come here, to see if I do. Well, maybe your chronicles will help. You've brought them? I have not, Begdil says, but my mind rushes through what Nerimace's words mean. He's either bluffing about being interested in the Rebel Temple's new immersion chronicles, or he doesn't have a monocle either. Or he has one and thinks new chronicles might give him insight on how to use it. I grit my teeth in frustration. Basically, it could mean anything. Easy enough, Nerimace says, cool as a barrel bottom. Why don't you call for them to be brought? We should have time enough for that, at least. I don't need to be connected to Begdil and Watersight to see his discomfort. Anon's thoughts register it, too. I will not. Not without a promise of the same from you, in a neutral location. A neutral location? Nerimace nods at the overseer, who strides towards the gates, and I feel a spike of concern from Anon. Stay, brother, I send. We knew this might happen. We're not in a neutral location, Begdil, Nerimace goes on. You came to me. Maybe some time in meditation will inspire you to call to your brethren. Or if you stay long enough, maybe they'll come on their own. I can't sneak out of the pits, Anon sends. Not if they're like Gaxna said. They won't send a senior monk to the pits, I think back, praying it's true. And I'm not convinced Nerimace doesn't already have a monocle. We're going to need your skills. The overseer shuts the gate, but ironically, Anon relaxes at the thought of burgling the temple. Begdil is still stone-faced. You're taking me hostage? A full brother of the faith? Not hostage, Nerimace says, stepping out of the water. This is your home, Begdil, not some abandoned silk factory in the highlands. You just need some time to remember that. Hopefully, it will encourage our lost brothers up there to do the same. Never in the history of our faith have we locked up one of our own. I'm not sending you to the pits, Nerimace says, and a little of the tension leaves my belly. But you will have to stay in your rooms. I'm sure you understand. I understand that you have always lied and forced your way into power, or murdered, in the case of our rightful chosen. Ah, now the words come out. Would you rather I murdered you here than kept you as bait? Begdil's face stays stony, but his eyes dart. As I thought, Nerimace says, not ready for your final immersion either. Hemlin, you will see him to his chambers. He turns to go.
Nerimes, Begdil says, using his name for the first time. Please. We shared a house once, ages ago. You must see this is bigger than a power struggle between our temples. The floods are coming, brother.
So they are, the Chosen of Ujjayi says, but I disagree. A power struggle is all this has ever been, Begdil, and to the winner goes the world.
Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that. I had a lot of fun writing this chapter, partially because Nerimes has figured so largely in Alethea's thoughts, and he's been sending enemies against her since the end of Book 1. Well, I mean, even in the beginning of Book 1. But we haven't seen him, we haven't talked to him for 3 books now. In Witch of Wealth and Ruin and Rebel of Riddle and Woe, he was just like sending his minions or sending his allies against Alethea, but never coming in person and never talking to her in person. And so it was really satisfying to write this dialogue where still she's not talking to him directly, and I don't think it's too spoiler to say that she will eventually, but she gets to hear him talk and in a way respond to him because they've talked about the conversation that's going to come. And it was, for me, just really fun to have him back on the page. I also like narrating in his particular voice. I don't know what that voice is or where it came from, but that's the voice I picked for him, and I like doing it. I never know if my audiobook voices are like help you be in the story or if they're just ridiculous, but they come out of me naturally, so I don't question it too much. But I think another one of the things that was really satisfying about writing this chapter and the chapters that have Nerimes later is that it felt like coming full circle. Alethea has had a lot of enemies and a lot of challenges in the course of the Chronicles, but her first one, the one we meet in the very first chapter, like almost the first page, is this guy, Nerimes. The one who, here comes the spoilers, murdered her father. The one who seems to be the most powerful hierarchist behind all of the shit that's happening. The one who is most directly opposed to her goal inherited from her father of stopping the floods. This is the guy. So it was really satisfying to come back to him and feel like, yes, I have been telling one big long story in this series and not 4 individual stories lumped together. And like I talked about in the first or second preview episode, there's just so much more weight that comes with already having this stuff established and having a history. So it felt instantly more dramatic and like the stakes were higher because we know so much about him and what he's trying to do. And same with Alethea. So it was really fun to write. And it was a big goal of mine to make good on the promise that was implicit in Book 1 that she will have her showdown with him and this conflict will get resolved, hopefully with her winning. That was forefront in my mind, even though so much has happened and her goals and her enemies have all shifted. And there were a lot of promises like that that I made in Book 1. Promises about making peace with her father and understanding her heritage, coming to terms with her gender and what it means for the magic that she can use and her identity and overcoming the things that she's been taught in that regard to see things more objectively. The threat of the floods, we didn't really know what they were until that vision in the end of Book 1 when she sees the floods coming and wiping out her city and her weeping water from one eye and blood from another. I was just making that shit up. Like, I was just going with it and did not have a plan, but I knew as I did it that I was going to have to make good on it. That's a promise to you as the reader that before this series is done, you're going to see this happen or you're going to see her avert this thing. And the immersion that she had that first time obviously has ended up playing such a heavy role in all of the books, and it does in this one too. And I think probably biggest of all, yeah, was the promise of that vision that she had. It's kind of like Book 1 up until that point had been a murder mystery thriller of her trying to figure out who killed her dad or how Nerimes killed her and running from him as he tries to get her dead and falling in love, but mostly a mystery about that thing. And then she knows that her dad cared about something, and then she has this vision when she should be dying. Instead, she sees why he cared about it. And in Book 2, she starts to get deeper into it and to search for his legacy and to pick up where he left off. But the vision is really where we start the overarching plot of the floods and the people who are trying to control them and use them versus the people trying to stop them, which is everyone in a very impotent way, except for Alethea, who finds a real way to do it and pushes it forward. And of course, we have to bring that to a conclusion in this book too. So there was so much there. And this is probably the point where I should admit that artistically, I've never been very interested in finishing things. I used to love making giant collages, like wall-sized collages while I was in college. And I would always get them about 90% covered and just stop and move on to the next thing. And it was the same with the songs that I would write back then. I would write the main melody and the chords and get the whole thing down. And then would come the time when I should fine tune. And my good friend Raleigh is like the master of fine tuning. We'll try different key signatures and timelines and endlessly tinker with the songs that he's writing. And I would get them mostly to the point where they're ready to tinker with and just be done. And if you've followed along with me, you'll know that I hate revision. And that is the tinkering point in a book when really you do need to put in the effort to make the book the best it can be, but all the storytelling is pretty much done. All the artistic parts are done and it's just kind of mechanical. And I've always felt that way as an artist, that I'm not interested in the mechanical part. I just want to do the creative part and then be done. But, you know, unfortunately, that's not the reality of making art for other people. And this book, in some ways, is me overcoming that hurdle because I have to finish the series and make good on all these promises and give you a complete story in a way that if you've read The Empire of Resonance, my first series, you'll know that I didn't. I tried to bring that series to a close at the end of book four, but it's obvious that half of the main characters have not been in the book and there are overarching plots that have not been resolved. And I just lost interest artistically in it. And I still have good intentions to go back and finish that series and probably revise the first four books and make them better, but at least to finish it, because I think it's important and it's a disservice to readers. And it's also something that I need to learn as an author, that it's better for me to tell a complete story and it's obviously better for the readers to get a complete story. So even though I have this resistance to finishing a story when it starts to feel like it's already done in my mind, I need to get it down. And fortunately, this book didn't feel like that too much, but I did find it really challenging to figure out how to make good on all those promises, the explicit and implicit ones that started in book one. And I kept laying more down in book two and book three and doing so pretty willy-nilly. I did not have a plan. And I had to think through, how do I get to that ending that I just kind of imagined and threw out there from the text that's already there with a text in this book that doesn't itself suck because I'm trying to combine two unlike things. And those limitations, rather than bother me or rather than kind of hold the story back from being the best that it can be, I think, like I've again talked about elsewhere, I think those limitations made the story better because I had to make it work inside all of these boundaries. And that just made me more creative and think more deeply than if the world had been my oyster, like in a book one, you can kind of do whatever you want. And in some ways that doesn't push you to do the best that you can because you don't have any problems to solve. You're just making problems, basically. And in this book, I'm solving problems. So yeah, I think that it made the book a lot better. And I think that it was good for me as an artist or as an author to force myself to find resolution to all of those promises, whether Alethea wins or loses, whether it turns out the way you wanted it to or not. I think it's better if she doesn't always win and it doesn't always end predictably, but it needs some kind of resolution. I personally despise a story that just kind of drifts off and doesn't give you any resolution or feeling that this is what I've been reading for. I want to bring my stories to a resounding conclusion. I think maybe I do that almost too much, but that's the direction that I tend towards. And so it felt really good to do it with a series instead of just with an individual book. So I hope that if you get a chance to read the rest of the book, you feel the same way. I've gotten such wonderful feedback from my early readers and from now, because the book is live, the reviews that are coming in on it. People seem to share my opinion that I stuck the landing on this one, which is hard for me to say because I always feel that I could stick it harder or more perfectly or whatever. But I think I have to say that I did a good job and that feels more than just subjective because other people are too. So I hope you join us in having that opinion and mostly in just enjoying finding resolution and closure to this story that maybe you have been reading with me for a long time, or maybe you've just come to, but you still have started to care about. It meant a lot to me, I think, because Alethea means a lot to me. The things that she cares about have ended up being the things that I care about. And of course, our world isn't threatened by a flood in the same way, but our understanding of society is threatened by the very same things that she is finding she has to unlearn to get through it. And that's the sort of like hidden soapboxy part of this series. And I never want to be on a soapbox when I'm writing, but I did find a lot of value and meaning in exploring the ideas here, the themes of social fictions and how toxic they can be and how much power is waiting for us if we unlearn them and grow past them. And that is certainly a promise that I go deeper on and fulfill in this book. So I hope you enjoy reading it or listening to it, however you come to it. It is there for you in all formats now. There's a link to that in the show notes. Thank you, as always, for listening. This podcast will probably go back to being very intermittent after this series of previews, but I do have intentions to put more episodes up every now and then. And I love that you're out there listening. So until next time, hope this finds you well and in the company of good books.
For more information on Levi Jacobs and his books, including the award-winning Tide Collar Chronicles, visit www.levijacobs.com. Or for a free audiobook, only available to podcast listeners, go to www.levijacobs.com/free. Thanks for listening, and read on.